Basic idea, separate, unify. We are talking about the unification stage. Understanding separates out, and then it reunites with the body. That's the poetic language. We've talked about the body as meaning several different things. The unconscious, really I think you could say the unconscious emotions, unconscious desires. And the physical body itself, because that's where emotions come from. And the real world, because it's in contact with the real world that you have emotions. I think that's the only really confusing part here. Another word is we're talking about the unio corporalis, the one body. I mentioned very briefly Bonhoeffer and Teilhard. I thought I'd just take a minute and read you a paragraph out of each of their works. I gave you the wrong title for Teilhard. I gave you the wrong author. It's Ursula Cain. Pass this around if you want to look at it. It's a biography of Teilhard, which is really, really pleasant. Spirit of Fire. And I just mentioned these to kind of show that Jung isn't the only one talking about this kind of thing. And the way I kind of visualize it is that there is a movement in the collective unconscious toward this new way of experiencing life. And Jung picked it up. Other people have picked it up using different languages, but you can hear the similarities. And this is, I don't think I've read this to you. Have I? His vision. Teilhard, remember, was that Catholic, French Catholic priest who was a medic at the Battle of Verdun. And this is page 60 of the biography. The biographer writes, amid all the fray and danger of war, he sees and is lifted up by the face and figure of Christ, whose lines are melting away into the universe. You see, there you get God becoming earth. Exactly what we're talking about. At the lowest point of human history, probably, the Battle of Verdun. Melting away into the universe toward infinity. The entire world is vibrant with movement, with life emanating from Christ's heart, the dazzling center of matter. And matter and divinity are things brought together. Same idea. Here he first describes the radiant power, majesty, and beauty of Christ, to which he returned in later years again and again. Ardently gazing into the pupil of Christ's eyes, he describes himself as dumbfounded before these, quote, abysses of fiery, fascinating life. So not exactly a lamb anymore. He could not decide whether their powerful final expression denoted an indescribable agony or a superabundance of triumphant joy. But he knew he caught a glimpse of these absorbing eyes once again, quote, in the glance of a dying soldier. That's something. Same, similar idea. And Bonhoeffer was the guy who was hanged for taking part in the... He was a Protestant theologian who was hanged for the for taking part in the attempted murder on Hitler. And
Bonhoeffer got out of Germany too and went back.
Right.
And he said, "I can't participate in the reconstruction of Germany if I leave." And so
yeah, it's an amazing story. He must have been an amazing man. He's talking about the letters in which these ideas are expressed. There was a selection of them in Letters and Papers from Prison. This is page 159. They begin on 18 November 1943. That's when he was imprisoned. And contain breathtaking beginnings of a new theology, reflections on a religionless Christianity. Religionless Christianity, that was his phrase.
I like that.
I like that too.
Yeah.
We are entering into a completely religionless time. People simply cannot be religious any longer as they once were. Where is there still room for God? The answer leads in a radical way to life in this world. God is the beyond in the midst of us. The God who is with us. The God who forsakes us. And he wrote this, I think he had about 6 months to live. I thought that I could acquire faith by trying to live a holy life, or something like that. I discovered later, and I'm still discovering right up to this moment, that it is only by living completely in this world that one learns to have faith.
What page is that?
171.
Okay.
Those are well-written and not too demanding books. A quick review of the main images. Page 374, we talked about this whole thing of clothing, putting a clothing on, that wisdom clothes the man, which is the spiritualization of the body. She mentions on 375 the idea that we've been working with all along, that Sophia is a dimension of God that has been excluded, but it is a dimension of God that is trying to return to modern experience. And the other shift that occurs with it is that the relationship to matter is reevaluated. We kind of go off on a little bit of a tangent, but I think it was important to talk about evolution as another place where it's being entertained that there is a spirit in matter, because evolutionary development apparently seems to not be totally explainable on the basis of natural selection, and some biologists are talking about the purpose of the evolving organism. Again, not exactly what we're doing, but similar. You can kind of see that different ideas are being, the same idea is being broached from several different disciplines, from several different angles. 375, 376, we mentioned what we've been saying several times, that this is a process going on in his unconscious. He's not understanding it, but that doesn't matter. It still runs itself anyway. So the value is in looking at the process almost more so because consciousness is not interfering with it. 376, we got what I call a poetic description of wisdom in the quote, last two lines, I am the flower of the field and the lily of the valleys, I am the mother of fear, love, and of knowledge, and of holy hope. So, you know, you could practically say, as von Franz said in the tape, what this does, it makes people kinder. I think that's the bottom line. It's the beginning of fair play in human encounter. We talked about the image of the vineyard on 377, very simply, that Sophia has to do with being able to be bountiful, both to yourself and to other people. It never ceases to amaze me how people who are selfish to others, you would think are good to themselves, but they're just as selfish to themselves as they are to others when it comes to the emotional self. So generosity and self-giving are not antithetical. I mean, they may have a big house and a big car, but you look at their emotional life and they're dried up, and their friends generally can attest to that. Couple of other images on 378. The sword and the bed. The sword was simply that the anima still, or this experience still contains within it the possibility of being problematic and upsetting. The bed is a little more complicated, and we're going to be following that through. The sentence that's important, which is where we left off, top of 379, in this sense, the bride serves as a vas conjunctionis for man and God, for man with God. Vaz Community Units would be a vessel for union. So that Sophia is described as a vessel. I tried to put that in my own words to mean that the experience of meaning extracted out of these difficult moments that we've been talking about all along brings with it the proclivity or capacity or desire or ability to be brought into real time and space life. So that the spirit at that level wants to reconnect with living, and that's part of its nature. We're going to be seeing more of that, this business of the union. Basically, we have been saying that wisdom comes to matter, but we'll also be saying matter comes to wisdom. And it sounds a little confusing to the linear mind, but if you remember that the conjunction is a mutual interpenetration. The spirit becomes matter and the matter becomes spirit. Meaning, putting it as simply as I possibly can, the material world becomes the directive for our own growth. One sees that time and time again. As the work gets to the point of any depth. That's what we did last time.
Could you give us an example of that?
You know, I just saw an amazing example of that. I was talking with a guy who has been involved in kind of political work and got burnout. Rightly so. He'd done his job. And we've been talking for quite some time how his, I wouldn't say despair, but kind of a case of the blahs, was really the death of that old way of living. And it was supposed to be so, because it was supposed to appear boring, because there's a new phase ahead, and the dreams have begun dealing with it, giving him some hints of in the direction of recovering some early creative interests. Well, he came in after having, we really got that point clear last week. Just, he got it, you know. Came in yesterday, huge bandage on his finger. He had almost cut his finger off slicing bread.
Bread.
He was slicing some bread, talking.
Oh, my gosh.
Had to be taken to the hospital, stitched up, you know, it's all in thingies. He said, what is that about? And I said, well, that's actually what I wrote my thesis on. That when it's time to transform creativity, the dream image, which appears very frequently in dreams of cut fingers.
Huh.
Except that played itself out in reality. The logic behind it is the finger, you probably already talked about this before, have you? The finger is, the word for finger is dactylos in Greek. And the word for dwarf is dactylos in Greek. So in Greek, it's the same word for dwarf and finger. And the wounding of the finger is a wounding of one's own creativity. Because the finger stands for creativity. And I collected about 15 of these dreams when I was doing my thesis. And the common element was that the dreams of wounded creativity occurred when the creativity needed to be wounded from the point of view of the self. The old creative organization was ready to be transformed. The person dreamt of the cut finger representing the boredom they were feeling with their old creative style, whatever it might have been, and a death, but to be succeeded by a rebirth. And it's amazing how people started with cut fingers would just start showing up in my life. It was actually a little unnerving. I remember Jim Hollis. I ran into him one day at the department store, and I said, "Hi, Jim, how you doing?" He put out his hand. Blood was gushing out of his finger. He had no idea he even cut it. So that's the sort of things that start happening when you work on unconscious images. But that's an example. I said, you could have had a dream, but you got a dream on the outside. That image in the material world was just as much a symbol as a dream might have been.
Amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, I don't think this person is this guy's particularly stubborn, but there's a little bit of stubbornness there in that, I'm pretty good at what I was doing.
Yeah.
And so we don't want to give it up. And so I think this sort of thing concretizes itself when the ego is a little reluctant to go along. Mm-hmm. And, if you notice this image, you'll see it all over the place. So White starts off with a queen cutting her finger. We just watched Madame Bovary in my French class, and she pricks her finger twice in the movie. Once when she meets her future husband, and secondly when she starts to go to the larger town where they move to, and she definitely had a problem with creativity. I mean, she was sort of a social gadfly who could not be creative. When I was in Zurich, tracked down actually a couple of Indian medicine men they brought over to teach us. And one guy said in his tribe, I think it was he was Sioux, before they passed laws that prohibiting mutation in religious context, the shaman used to cut off their finger. That was part of the initiation. And it was to symbolize the loss of their own power and the surrender to the greater power, which fits very much in with what I was seeing as creativity being injured, and then one listens to the unconscious to see how it gets reoriented. So that's an example. The physical world becomes the image. Body, events, synchronicity, disease, desire, I think, for the moment. Other questions? Okay, 379. Some of this I think we can go through kind of quickly, then some we'll slow down and look at with care. I am off there, and there is no spot in me, looking through the windows, looking through the lattices of my beloved, wounding his heart with one of my eyes and with one hair of my neck. I think the main image there is the eye that wounds. One of the key images of the self is the eye. And if you look at those early Egyptian paintings in bas reliefs, you see how prevalent the eye was used to represent the divinity. And that would mean that there is another consciousness in us looking at us. And when we see that sight in us, seeing us, when we see ourselves being seen, it is usually very upsetting. Which means that we are able to see ourselves the way the self sees us. And since the self is our totality and we are a part, usually that sight of the totality leaves us feeling pretty paltry. So it's like your real potential sees what you could be, and it doesn't say, oh, nice job. It says, you haven't done this, you haven't done this, you haven't done this, you haven't done this. And I think that's what's being pointed at here, that that being seen is a wounding. And, you know, if you wanted to follow it up, you could, I won't take time here, but Edinger in The Apocalypse Archetypes gives quite a few dreams of being seen by a cosmic eye, and the person is devastated. It's usually a very harsh eye. It's also part of the problem in therapy that people project that eye onto the therapist, can project it onto the therapist, and anticipate the therapist's sight to be rejecting because something in them knows they are a poor excuse of what they should be. It'd be like the archetypal dimension of that therapist-client relationship. Or I think in any relationship, people who are extremely defensive to feedback are experiencing the honest-to-God feedback as the I in themselves, which is judging them, and with all that power. Another image is the hair, it's going to be so easy to get confused here. What I'm going to try to do is make it a little bit easier and just say there's going to be images of one penetrating the other and the other penetrating the one. Here, wisdom penetrates him, but we've seen images of him planting seeds in her. So instead of trying to get too crazy about all the fineries, just realize that spirit penetrates matter and matter penetrates spirit. In the example of the finger, that the spirit would be the image producing capacity penetrated into matter to make matter symbolic. And the penetration of matter into spirit would be that that material event became a symbol. We'll see that back and forth. But that's that matter and spirit no longer cease being two things at certain moments.
So you said matter becomes a symbol and spirit?
And matter becomes a symbol and the symbol becomes material. The next passage, 379 at the bottom, I am the sweet smell of ointments. To make it short, that's just a reference to the Holy Spirit, which is supposed to bestow a sweet smell, which is why they have the incense in the Catholic Church. So linking this up with the idea of the Spirit. Now, this next one on 380 is a little tough. I'll see if I can simplify it a bit. I'm the most prudent virgin, coming forth as the dawn, shining exceedingly, elect as the sun, fair as the moon, besides what is hid within. I think the key phrase there is besides what is hid within, meaning the spirit is within this experience. That's how I would try to say it very simply. There's more there, but I think for our purposes, that's enough. Another repeat. I am exalted there at the bottom. 380, I am exalted as the cedar and the cypress tree on Mount Zion. I am the crown wherewith my beloved is crowned in the day of his espousals and his joy. For my name is as an anointed, I've been put forth. Again, we have the crown image, which is showing that Sophia is a crown put on the bridegroom, which is the material world. So she is the spirit which adorns the matter. Again, you can think of the example. That the material world became symbolic.
Sophia is the spirit that adorns the man?
Matter.
Matter.
Yeah, the man symbolizes matter. She goes on to other things, but that's the main idea. The only other detail maybe to mention over in 382, because actually it does show up in dreams, and thank God it's not as bad now as it used to be, but the incest motif. You know, it was the rage. Everybody was sexually abused there for a while. And that incest motif does appear in dreams, but it does not always mean incest. And one of the characteristics of this of the variety of ways that the psyche can symbolize this crowning motif is in an incestuous context, meaning illicit. When matter becomes spirit and spirit becomes matter, that is such an affront to our common sense as to be kinky. And the surreptitious nature of that union can, and the disgusting nature of that union can be described in dreams as incest. That's what she's mentioning on the top of 382. So when you see incest dreams, you've got to be really careful. Is that about a physical incest, or is it about a union which, from some point of view, should not happen? And then do we side with the point of view that says no union, or do we help the individual fight that principle and have the union even though it's disgusting? I am the sling of David, halfway down. The stone wherefrom tore out the great eye of Goliath. Excuse me. And finally took off his head. A repeat, the anima still can be dangerous. And rather than just waltz into a person's life, it comes in carrying machine guns. The eye of Goliath, Goliath would represent the drive of large unconscious instincts. So the destruction of the eye would be the destruction of one-sided vision. You know, gimme, gimme, gimme.
In the footnote here, footnote 112, they talk about the egg. do I understand that to mean that the egg is, they're equating the egg with the, how do they put it, with the spirit in matter? It's a footnote.
I think so.
Okay.
The only problem is that one point, one thing's going to be the egg, and the next point, the other thing's going to be the egg. That's the only place where I got confused. But, you know, the idea is something coming out of something else. Like in the finger example, a meaning came out of that physical event. Like a chicken hatches out of an egg.
Question about I guess methodology or something. When you're confronting these kind of images, these contradictory images that come up in dreams or in the material world in everyday life, what kind of attitude do you have to take to these? I mean, you're suggesting you don't side. You have to decide whether you're going to side with, for example, the union, or decide that no, that's reprehensible and can't do that. I mean, so I guess the attitude to take is one of openness to the conflict, or the possibility that the path of least resistance is not the path to take?
All of the above. You know, we talked about this in several different contexts and several of the groups I've been doing, and I wish I could give a clear answer.
That's why people go to therapy, right?
I'm afraid it is. It's a feeling judgment.
It's feeling.
It's feeling, and people say, well, how do you know? How do you know? And I don't know how you know. You just know. I think, as I mentioned, I think we talked about this on the Saturday group, the way we're trained is we first go through it ourselves. So you feel how it was when your own therapist helped you make these assessments to your own material. And you know, just like you know how to swing a baseball bat, you just start doing it. You cannot teach this abstractly. That's why our work is trained. We are trained the way we are. Where a classical clinical psychologist is taught by learning things to do. We're not taught that way. We're taught it by feeling what it was like to experience it, and then you just know it. It, of course, it is the most delicate part of the work, and I certainly don't want to suggest that I always get it right, but you kind of start getting a feeling.
That would say that everyone's experience is the same.
Sorry?
It would say that everyone's experience is the same as the one you had, or the therapist.
Well,
you.
Yeah, it does go in that direction that there is such a thing as objectively true value judgments. Yeah, and that gets people upset. That's like a swear word today.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're being judgmental. Yeah, I am. Because nature makes judgments, and I'm simply passing hers on to you. But we don't like that. The ego, you see, is then tied to some other point of view. That's the I. Now, of course, I think in the human sphere, you always have to present it. This is how I understand it. And I think you always, the therapist always has to make room. I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But since you're paying me, here's how I see it,
mm-hmm.
And we'll time will tell whether it's right or wrong. And I think time is the final litmus test. Yeah, it's very, very difficult.
Well, and that connects with the idea of Sophia's absolute knowledge.
Absolutely, that there is a right and a wrong way to go, not morally, but in the direction of realizing your own purpose in life.
And that indwelling within each individual is a recognition of whether or not it is the appropriate.
There is an organ in us that knows that.
An organ.
Yeah, it's like an organ.
An organ of consciousness.
An organ of consciousness.
But it wouldn't be the self.
I think it would be connected with itself. I would call it the feeling function.
Okay.
I told you the story about Jung and von Franz and woman whose husband was killed in a plane crash. I'll tell you that story. Just to give you an example of how this works. Well, von Franz tells a story that I'm sure I told you. Stop me if you remember. That she was supervising an analyst whose client's fiance was killed in a plane crash. And von Franz was presented with about 20 dreams that the student analyst's client was having about her dead fiance. And the problem was that this woman couldn't stop dreaming about her dead fiance. She couldn't get over it. And so this student analyst went to von Franz for some help understanding these dreams. And so von Franz read these 20 dreams, and she said, we're dealing here with an animus projection that she's been unable to withdraw, and that's what these dreams are about. But these four dreams, boom, 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 are a communication of that deceased fiancé's spirit from the other world. Don't interpret those. And she said, the student analyst was a rationalist and said, oh, bullshit, and got up and walked out. And behind her back went to see Jung and presented these 20 dreams to Jung. And Jung said, well, you can see that we've got basically a situation where the animus is not able to be withdrawn from projection, except for these four dreams. Boom, 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 boom. Don't interpret those. They are the voice of the deceased spouse from another world. So you just, if you know this world, you just know what this stuff is. It's like a writer just knows how to construct that sentence. You could study grammar forever, but you either have it or you don't have it. And that's the way dream work is.
So don't interpret them because they are their own truth and they don't lend themselves to interpretation.
What's that?
The dreams.
Four dreams.
Those four dreams. Yeah, don't interpret them because they are him speaking. And he's got something to say to her.
Well, then why would you tell
her? Pardon me?
Well, then why wouldn't you go ahead and interpret them?
Just the same way you wouldn't interpret a conversation. You would just say, he's speaking, and this is what he's saying. He is saying, this is him speaking.
Okay.
From the other side.
You wouldn't tell the client that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
But see, the trainee was a rationalist and didn't want to accept that there could be another dimension to reality other than psychological.
Okay.
That was the problem. Okay. But it was an instance where two people came up with the exact same assessment. Yeah.
Does he ever write about communication like that?
Not a whole lot, no. He does occasionally.
He had an innate belief in it.
I don't know if it was a belief. I think he saw it as a fact. Yeah.
So if your feeling function is inferior, then you'd have more trouble with...
And we live in a country with terrible feeling function.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right.
So that's where the struggle comes.
That's where the struggle comes. Yeah, I mean, go to Castleton and go to a medieval European village and look at the difference of feeling. There you can see. It just feels right. That's feeling. It's almost impossible to describe. But, you know, Jung's definition, it's a function which bestows and assesses value. And what's so hard is we don't quite realize even what value is. Because we're such a rationalistic and technological society.
I think even when people, or certainly I speak for myself, you know, started working with the different functions, feeling means emotions, not values.
Right.
And I think that's where everybody mm-hmm. comes to, and I have to keep reminding myself what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not emotions.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a thinking type. I've had to work so hard and developing this. And I work with all feeling types in my training just for that reason. Every one of my people are feeling types or feeling intuitives. And oh, it was hard. Because you can't control. It controls you.
You can't think it through.
You can't think it through. It says, and it is, you know.
And every time you think you got it figured out, you
go. There's another storm that comes.
But are you getting it when you're doing things that feel right?
That's a very difficult question, because drug addicts feel right shooting up. I would say maybe, maybe not. The point would be to get conscious of your feeling functions so you can sort of trust when you feel things are right. But part of the problem in getting conscious of your feeling function, if your feeling function is not developed, is that you have to learn things that feel right aren't right.
So what can you trust?
The assessment of other people and time.
Well, the dreams would comment on it too.
Yeah, but I think she's getting the point, how do you even get to trust your dreams? I think it has to come through, for me, it came through our relationship to another person. My own therapist. And again, knowing is not foolproof, but one attempts these assessments and then one sees what follows subsequently, either in one's life or in further dreams.
And doesn't the ego often make you feel like it's right when it's not
yeah,
at all?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you want it to be that way?
Yeah. I think one of the things that would come out of an experience like this where the ego has been so overwhelmed and discombobulated is it realizes that it's not sovereign anymore. Oh. And there's nothing wrong with making judgments from the ego, but then it's always like, okay, over to you, click the microphone off and wait to hear what comes. But truly, we live in a time where it's feeling is like an endangered species. Otherwise, we wouldn't have such a crazy country. You know, my current soapbox. What sort of feeling function builds sports stadiums and closes down schools, police stations, and fire stations? That's feeling error. It's sick. No place else in the world does that except here. So we really have a great difficulty with this, but I can tell you it is really interesting to try to develop it. It is very interesting to be able to start making the right decisions. Okay, speaking of that, we go to 383. I am the scepter of the house of Israel, the top of the page in the key of Jesse, which openeth, and so on. See, the scepter is the law within Sophia. It is the values which she holds as law. Again, it's not the law of right and wrong. It's the law of what serves life and what doesn't serve life. And it is annoying. You think you get into Sophia that you are freed from law, and you walk from one set of rules into another. I personally prefer her rules, but because you can, they're much more. They give much more space to humanity and mistakes and desire and inquiry. But they're just as rigorous. So where the Ten Commandments might say, thou shalt not have an affair, Sophia might say, thou shalt have an affair. And pretty soon your marriage is in shambles. The key is simply the sense that Sophia gives us a tool to open the doors which seemed locked throughout life. (clears throat) 383 on that chosen vineyard. More of the same. The fruitfulness. Again, I'm simplifying a bit, but that's the main point. The next passage at the bottom, very bottom of 383. Wherefore have all the philosophers would be alchemists, commended me and sowed in me their gold and silver and incombustible grain. Again, the idea of interpenetration. I think that's the main point. So that takes us over to 385, and I want to just slow down for a minute and look at 385. What happens in the words of some accounts is that a mystic earth is created. That should make sense, that the physical world becomes symbolic. That means mystic earth. It begins to have a spiritual effect. Spiritual in the sense of helping you grow. But the key words there is lower trinity. Mystic earth is therefore a kind of lower trinity. Now, what's the upper trinity? Let's start there.
Trinity? Father, Son, Holy
Spirit? Yeah, literally, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. But psychologically, what's that mean? I'm making a triangle.
Unity.
Unity in the Spirit. The idea is that the Spirit, again, remember, we're taking as a legitimate psychological function that is not derived from anything else. The Spirit is the psyche's capacity to guide us. So Jung could take very earnestly the fact that the Spirit was present in Christianity as Christianity led civilization away from Roman barbarism into some sort of pattern of decency. Now, the church would say that's the Holy Spirit. Jung says, I don't know whether it's holy or not, but it sure is what I call the Spirit. And the way that Spirit worked was to guide people through experiences of ecstasy and light and exaltation and goodness. And it shows up in dreams as triangles, guiding. However, lately, in the last 100 years or so, I think, it has started showing up as the problem. There's a dream in the dream analysis seminar, those of you who did that, of an airplane which has to descend. See, an airplane is a triangle, wings and... And the guy was flying in the airplane, and his situation didn't improve until that plane was brought to the ground. So that Trinity now, for reasons we could talk about, but we don't need to get into, that kind of revelation is actually now not the solution to our time, but the problem of our time. That was not so 2,000 years ago. It is so today. There is still a trinity. There's still a triangle around in dreams, which is a trustworthy guide, but it's not in the air. It's on the ground. Three animals, three coins, three feathers. It shows up in dreams. And that is also an image of the spirit. But now that spirit is trustworthy and generally is a reliable guide. So what Jung came to say is there are two dimensions to the spirit. There's an upper and lower trinity. There's an upper trinity in which the spirit manifests itself in light, and there's a spirit which manifests itself in darkness. There's a spirit which manifests itself top down. There's a spirit which manifests itself bottom up. Well, you can see what I've just described as the lower trinity is what we've been talking about in terms of Sophia. So Sophia is connected with the lower trinity, and the lower trinity is simply that excess access of the spirit into our consciousness through nature, through matter, through darkness, through chaos, through defeat, through heartache.
So would it be just the human experience?
Well, I think he would say, not psychologically, that the spirit is a guiding factor in the psyche that can approach us in an atmosphere of light or in an atmosphere of darkness. That is a psychological truth of the human personality. What Christianity did was experience that spirit only in one half of its totality. And what we're faced with now is realizing that that half of the totality is leading us astray. But there is another dimension of the spirit which is trustworthy, and that's the part of the spirit that Christianity did not symbolize. And it's a dark spirit, or it comes to us through darkness. And that's exactly what Sophia is. Yeah.
Would you distinguish, okay, the darkness could be your own generating, like having an affair or something like that.
Depression, affair, heartache.
What about like Job's situation where darkness came from exterior
things?
Is this the same?
Absolutely. Same.
Something that you haven't generated, or
you Yeah, I didn't mean to say you necessarily generated it. If I said that, I didn't want to say it. I mean, life gives you situations. You could say, well, I would say, well, I'm not just talking about being promiscuous, but if you're in despair in a marriage and you just know you have to have an affair, you're going to die, and that's a prelude to a divorce, perhaps, you could say that experience was forced on you. Or people might choose to do something destructive in a flip moment, and then when processing the consequences, realizing that there was a deeper meaning underneath it.
Okay, I guess, and I'm just thinking you're saying the same thing, but people that like a woman who's raped, you know what I'm saying? Where's the meaning that is so forced upon? I guess what I'm not understanding how that would fit.
I discussed this with one of the women at the Julian Center, and she never talked with me again. I saw a dream of a woman who was raped recently, and 9 months after she was raped, she dreamt a beautiful child was born. Now, I'm not going to go around telling people that rape's a good thing, But yet one can see sometimes out of these horrific experiences a indisputably valuable development starts. That would be Sophia. Absolutely.
Now, I've never understood this certainly fully, but that quote of Jung's that there's nothing so evil that good cannot come from it, and nothing so good that evil cannot come from it.
Yeah.
And something like that happens, that's the only thing I can think of. It's like, well, surely there's something here. There's going
to
be.
It's very difficult, and this is why Jung wrote Answer. One of the reasons I think he wrote Answer to Job, you see, you've got to be so careful. If somebody comes in raped, and you say, oh, something good's going to come out of this, you know. They'll kill you. The ego cannot be about the divine dimension of the experience. That's what Jung felt was so important about the book of Job. Job never stopped saying, Yahweh, you are wrong. And when Job finally does capitulate, theologians will say, well, you see, that means God knows better. And Jung's response is, what are you supposed to say when you're looking down the barrel of a howitzer? That's no victory. Yahweh just beat Job to a pulp till he couldn't stand up anymore. And Job's strength is in the wisdom of the book of Job, is in telling us, do not do anything that short circuits the misery and protest of the ego that is being violated. That's our job, to stand up to the universe and say, this is wrong. Then God will take over. God will not take over until we have accused him of the injustice that has occurred. So, you know, I just want to vomit when I hear people who have come in after seeing pastoral counselors who have told them, oh, there's really a deeper meaning here. We just don't understand it, and we really shouldn't question God's wisdom in these matters. Yes, we should, as a matter of fact. And in doing so, that allows, whether you want to call it God, whether you want to call it the positive side of the self, to manifest. So the therapist's job then, to bring it very practically, is to support that person's rage and injustice and outrage. I never, ever, ever said to that person, something good has happened here. But despite it, the unconscious produced that dream. And then in time, we could begin to look at the changes that needed to occur in her life, which the disgust with life allowed to emerge out of her horrible experience. But for months, it was dealing with police and court and trials and upset and rage. And then and the thing started to shift. But I would call that Sophia.
But I'm wondering, that's exactly what I was getting. I'm thinking, you hear all those, you know, God knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to accept that. But had she accepted that, she might not have had that dream of a child, right?
That's Jung's point.
You know, I must have provoked that, right, by this, you know, place and around, you know, that type of thing.
I think why Jung examined the book of Job so closely is that he felt that is what that text was saying. Mm-hmm. Between the lines, that it's the ego's job to question God. Which is not to say the universe is meaningless, but it's part of our job to show consciousness to the world that God can't show to it. Try saying that in divinity school.
Yeah, but you get turned off too by like what you said about divinity school.
That's what I say. I said, try saying that in divinity school. They don't particularly care for that reason. Because see, God always knows better. That all that does is cooperate with the dark side of God, mm-hmm. who is responsible for horrible, horrible, horrible things. Yeah, you know, when they say, oh, he really knows what he's doing, so I say, he knew what he's doing about those 6 million dead Jews? Mm-hmm. And then they don't know what to say, really.
Even in the Bible, he goes out and kills children.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, it's a practical a question of practical import. Not only how do you judge this, but what what stance must the ego take in order to allow the positive side of the divinity to manifest, you might say. It's time to take a break.